It is good morning, and it's great to be here. We're so very thankful that God has allowed us to gather together in his presence. Want to make sure our visitors know that they are welcome. We appreciate you being here. I pray that we are an encouragement to you. And we got a lot of people gone, right? It's that time of year. People are taking vacations. We got a good handful that are sick. So want to be mindful of those who want to be here but can't, or they're on vacation. And then also, again, don't forget, we're going to have a potluck immediately after service, and we'll have our second service in the annex. And I know, don't worry, I do make that lesson we do in there really short, so don't use that as an excuse not to come. There's going to be plenty of food. I don't think anyone's ever left a potluck hungry. So plan on staying and being a part of that. And if you come back at 5 o'clock this evening, there won't be anybody here, right? No second service. You know the rule. If you show up when no one's here, don't leave. Come to my house and pull weeds, right? So we know the rules there. So keep that in mind. Also, same thing with the summer series that starts after VBS. You meet on Thursdays at 7, not Wednesday. If you show up Wednesday at 7, don't leave. Come to the house, pull some weeds. Now, this morning, we are going to do part 2 to our lesson that we began last week. And I just want to review a couple things here in a moment, what we looked at last week. But first, I want to tell you about a fella by the name of John O. Groats. And just throwing this out there, kind of like my Wednesday class, I had to recycle my PowerPoint because my laptop is in the shop, so a lot of this is going to seem very familiar to you, the screens for the most part. But there's this fella in the UK, in Britain, named John O. Groats. And it was his desire to walk from the far north to the far south of the island of Britain. And he did it. He went the whole way, but it took him a whole lot longer than he originally anticipated. And the reason why is he was arrested 16 times doing that walk. And he spent 5 months in jail. Now, why did he get arrested 16 times and spend 5 months in jail? Because he did that walk wearing nothing but a backpack and hiking boots. And at the end, when he made it, it was a big story. And you had the local news there and some national news, and they're interviewing him with champagne in hand. They said, well, why did you do this? And he said, quote, I want to change people's perspective on morality. He wanted to change people's morality. Now, you might hear that story and think, well, he's crazy. But listen, here's the thing. There are a lot of people in this world, a majority of people, they do not have the same moral standards as you. They do not have the same moral standards as God. So in this lesson, one of the primary goals here that we need to understand and be reminded of is if we do not have a deep, devoted faith to God and seek Him for the standard of morality, then we're going to have a completely broken moral compass. But if we do seek Him in all things and we seek His morals, His standard of morality, that's going to change absolutely everything in our lives. Absolutely change everything. Because God is one that sets the standard of morality. So if I can stretch your memory back to Ephesians chapter 4. And I want you to be reminded here. Well, let me actually go back a slide here. We looked at verses 17 through 19 last week, and we're kind of working on that list. There's six things there that God gives us. We looked at four of those six, and we're going to look at the last two in just a moment here. But let me read it all as a one big chunk here, if you would. If you've got your Bible open, Ephesians 4. Beginning verse 17, this I say, therefore, testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their minds, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feelings have given themselves over to, and here's the two we didn't look at, lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness. And real quick into verse 20, which we'll look at towards the end of this lesson, but you have not so learned, right? And if you remember this chart that we looked at last week, it's a Barna research group. This is actually from 2013. I couldn't find anything newer. And, you know, I'm not a betting man, but I'd bet that these numbers aren't any better in the last 13 years. And the whole point of this, you remember, it wasn't necessarily to debate the numbers. But I just want you to notice, right, you got the column of all adults and then the evangelicals. And according to their definitions, that's where we would fall in. In other words, these are people, by their definition, and I agree for the most part, people that say you ought to worship Jesus on Sunday, worship the Lord on Sunday. And he should guide your day-to-day principles the rest of the week. Right? And we would agree with that. Now, when you jump over to the born-again column, right, these are folks, according to their definition, that say, yes, you should worship Jesus on Sunday, but you know what? Monday through Saturday, that's for me. Right? And he's not guiding their day-to-day living. And so the whole point of this, looking at this, if you remember, was just notice the difference in the numbers and how that changes. Right? You even go all the way to that last column, the atheists, the agnostics, right? Because they don't have a standard. It's based on what they feel. And so the whole point of this is I want you to notice how the numbers change in the view of morality when you have Jesus as not only the focus of your worship, but he's guiding your day-to-day life. He's telling you how to live, and you accept that. To that next group, yeah, you know, I kind of like Jesus, but he doesn't really tell me what to do. I'm not up for that. And then the atheists and agnostics. Right, so the key here we need to remember is your relationship, your view of God determines the standard by which you will walk. In other words, your standard of morality. And so here in Ephesians chapter 4, right, if you look at this again here, and so verse 17, Paul says, this I say therefore and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk, right, that's our daily behavior. You should no longer walk or conduct yourselves as the rest of the Gentiles, and that's the heathens. Right? Basically, these are folks who do not have Jesus directing their day-to-day lives. Right? And he continues, and you should no longer walk like that. Why? Well, because you've been changed by Jesus. Right? Then he says, you know, why they walk without Jesus daily? It's because of the futility of the mind. At least New King James here. Right, and you remember that word, futility, means empty, right? Empty of morality, right? These are folks, they don't have a right and proper moral compass. Right, they're walking in moral depravity. Morally bankrupt. We might read this and ask, you know, well, why do heathens do immoral things? Right, well, it's because their mind is set on immoral things and it's not set on good, godly things, right? They don't have that inward compass, and they don't have that knowledge of God to guide them. That's why. And so as we pointed out last week, right, these six things here, and I always call it the slippery slope of immorality, right? And this is that, and he's given us a list, right? Man didn't make up this list. God made up this list. What happens? Why they go off they descend off the face of the mountain. Remember that analogy? And so he's telling us why. And so, right, here's how it begins. Do you remember verses 18 and 19? I read it. Look at it again. The first one, their understanding is darkness, right? There's this dimness of spiritual light. This is the first thing that happens. And, you know, this is where they literally convince themselves, you know, I used to always think that was wrong, but now, you know, I don't know. And then it's like, well, I don't think that's wrong anymore, right? Whatever that sin might be, right? They're starting to have their understanding darkened, the dimness of spiritual light in their lives. And so what happens next, if you remember this, Paul, number two here, it says they begin to alienate themselves from the life of God, right? And we added in that, remember we looked at John 3, They alienate themselves from the life and the light of God. You know, he could have said, you know, you're alienating yourselves from God. He doesn't say that. He could have said, you're alienating yourselves from other Christians. He doesn't say that. Although both are true. Right? He says, you're alienating yourself from the life of God. Right? And so we need to recognize when we're at this stage, I'm literally alienating myself from a place where I ought to be. And this is where I start to rationalize, you know, creating a distance between God and his people. You know, I used to feel so comfortable at church. I just don't feel comfortable anymore. And then it's, you know, I just don't even feel comfortable around Christian people anymore. And then it becomes, who do they think they are? Right? You ever see this in someone that's left the church? And if you're paying attention, right before they do, they're going to latch on to some area, some topic. Right, well, I would have stayed, but I tell you, elders did this, preacher preached that, whatever it is, so-and-so was mean and rude to me. You know, I would go, Lord, but, you know, hey, they did that or wouldn't do this. So I'm justified in creating that separation. What are they doing? They're alienating themselves from life and the light of God. And he's telling us how this whole process works. Listen, I cannot stand for immorality and stand in oneness with God. In other words, the life of God ought to be what I am living. And if I'm separating myself from that, that's on me. Isaiah 59, 1 and 2. My sin, my transgressions, my iniquity make it a separation between me and God. Next here, fourth, and this is where we left off last week. Right, they move into that place, very dangerous place, being past feeling. Right? If you remember, we looked at Jeremiah chapter 6, and you had those folks there that were involved in sin, and not only did they not blush because of that sin, they didn't even know how to blush anymore. And this is a very, very dangerous place to be. Right? This is that the hardening of the heart due to the deceitful nature of sin, Hebrews 3 and verse 13. Right? And if you remember, we talked about how foolish it would be if me as a Christian, I struggle with the sin, and you know, and when I commit that sin, it still hurts me that I hurt God with that sin, and you know, and I still get pricked in the heart when I do that. How foolish it is then of me to then go out and continue to practice that sin day after day, because there will come a point when you do not feel sorry you're committing that sin. What is that? Hardness of heart. That's callousness spiritually. That's being past feeling. You don't feel it anymore. That you're hurting God with your sin. A very, very dangerous place. You're not fighting it anymore. So next here, I want you to note this list that God gives us, Ephesians chapter 4. The very next thing that he tells us is lewdness. Right, here's at the point number 5. This is where lewdness takes over. Your translation might say lasciviousness. But lewdness, understand, is lawlessness. Right? In other words, we start to accept in our life that lawlessness against God. Right? Knowing that lawlessness is sin and sin is lawlessness, 1 John 3 verse 4. But notice this here, if you look at verse 19, he says, having given themselves over, notice that, have given themselves over to lewdness, having given themselves over to lasciviousness, right? In other words, hey, I'm not fighting it anymore. Right? I used to feel guilty about this, but not anymore. Right? I used to try to defend myself when I participated in this sin, but not anymore. I don't care. Right? You know, and even moves that point, yeah, practice evil, I'm proud of it. Have you ever interacted with somebody that's at that point? I have. And it's almost shocking. You know, it almost becomes an argument for justification, an addiction to that sin. But look at this last part here. Now we're going to end the lesson on the good. Right? We're just finishing up the bad, number 6. Look at this last part, verse 19. To work all uncleanness or impurity, with greediness, pleixia in the Greek there, that word, it means literally deeds of coveting. It's almost sin collecting. Oh, I can't get enough. Where it went, they're proud of sin. Now they're almost this idea of they're looking for more sin to be a part of. Complete and total debasement right here. We see a lot of this in our culture around us today. That they have a passion to collect sin. And said, you know, what else can I do? You know, how many times have you interacted with somebody that's young? You know, let's say early 20s, well, maybe even in the early 30s. And, you know, they turn over a leaf, but it's not a good leaf. And it just seems that everything that they used to believe, it's gone. Right? And they're literally looking for evil to do. Well, how did that take place? Well, we just read it right here. It takes place because the mind becomes futile. And you know, and you say, well, how does the mind become futile? Right? Well, he just gave us a list. That's how it happens. Remember, originally this was written to Christians, for Christians, about Christians. The book of Ephesians. And we can think about people that used to be our brothers and sisters in Christ, but where are they now? They're gone. They're back in a lifestyle of sin. Back lost in the world, the corruption of the world, as Peter writes in 2 Peter. This is what happens. Right? They might spend a little more time on one of these steps than the others, but I guarantee if you're able to go back and go through this is exactly what happens. And the point is, it can happen to you, and it can happen to me. So what's the answer to this? Let's spend our remaining time here. Three short points I want you to note here. What's the answer to that? Look at verse 20. Read it with me. But you have not so learned Christ. Well, the answer number one right here. You need to learn Christ. I must learn Christ. That's the answer. I don't have to walk like the Gentiles or the heathens do. Well, the beginning of the answer to that is to not have that futility of mind. I need to learn Christ. That's the number one thing. And if you work through the next few verses here, through 24, I want you to notice, right? So number one, you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and been taught by him as the truth in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct, the old man, which grows corrupt, according to deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. That's the answer. We see 3 points of that. Number one, it's you need to learn Jesus. Jump over to John chapter 9 here real quick. Be reminded of the story of the blind man. So, and I want you to think as you're turning over here to John 9, how can we know what's right? You know, how can we have a right set moral compass? Well, he says you got to learn Christ. And so here's the story of this blind man that's healed. And well, actually, remember this real quick. Notice he didn't say in Ephesians 4, I want you to learn about Jesus. That's not what he says. He said, rather, I want you to learn Christ. How do I understand that? Think about it this way. Hey, tomorrow we're going to meet back here, 5 o'clock, and we're gonna learn about George Washington. Well, we can do that, but what do we have to do? Well, we need to get some books about George Washington, right? Maybe do a Wikipedia search or whatever. We got to gather. We can learn about George Washington, but we can't learn George Washington because none of us has ever walked and lived with George Washington. You can only learn of the living. You can learn about the dead, but you can only learn the living. You know, how many wives here have learned your husbands, right? You can finish their sentence many times. How many parents have learned your children? Well, how do you do it? Well, because you live with them. You can only learn the living. Now, you can learn about the dead. So that's the difference here I wanted to point out. And so real quick here in John chapter 9, You remember what's going on in all of this? You got the blind man was healed, you know, and he was blind from birth. You remember that? This amazing healing, this miracle took place. Like, it didn't seem like anyone wanted to give Jesus credit. Matter of fact, the religious leaders, they put the formerly blind man's parents kind of on a little mini trial, if you would. How'd this happen? You think the parents would stand up for their now seeing formerly blind son? No. We don't know. Ask him. He's of age. Right? They didn't want to get kicked out of the synagogue. You remember what's going on here? Right? No one wanted to give Jesus credit. But notice, finally here, we read as they come back to the son, the formerly blind man responds in verse 25, and he answered and said, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. So this man saying, I know one thing, I'm experiencing something, right? Because I've met this man Jesus, because I've obeyed this man Jesus, I'm experiencing something that I've never experienced in my life. You see, this man experienced Jesus. Right now, you know, don't think I'm trying to tell you this morning that the only way to experience Jesus is to be healed miraculously. That's not what I'm saying. But this morning, if you've received him and if you've obeyed him, you're beginning to learn him. Now, we can learn about Jesus. We learn a lot of facts about Jesus, right? I can read the gospel accounts, learn about his birth, his life, his death, and all of that. That's great. That's needed. Now, we can learn about the doctrine of Jesus. That's good. That's necessary. That's needed. But to learn him, that's, I think, where we struggle, right? And, you know, like this formerly blind man was healed physically and spiritually, he learned Jesus, right? And no one could convince him otherwise. And I wonder how many of us here this morning have intellectually learned Jesus, right? And again, yeah, we can tell you a lot of facts about him, but we haven't truly tried to live the life he tells us to live and truly learn him, right? And therefore, we just continually fail. And so, friends and brethren, I need to realize that I don't need to just learn about Jesus. I need to learn Jesus, and hopefully we can see the difference, right? He's alive. The grave is found empty, so we can learn him. 1 Peter chapter 2, real quick before we move on to this second point. Peter here is going to write about the living Lord and urge us to have our life, look at this, open up your Bible, so we can be alive spiritually because we've built our lives on Jesus. Look at verse 1, 2 Peter chapter 2. And, you know, he would talk about laying aside all sin. And in verse 2, having a desire for the word of God. And then in verse 3, so that we could taste that the Lord is gracious. See that? And then speaking of the graciousness of the Lord, verse 4, coming to him as a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You see what Peter is calling us to do here? Right, he's calling us to build our lives upon Jesus Christ. He says, I want to remind you, he's not a dead stone. Right, we're not building on a dead foundation. Right, we're building on a living foundation. A foundation that was rejected by men. Right, those in darkness, immorality, they don't want to see the light. So I got a choice here. Am I going to choose the ways of Christ or my own fleshly desires? And, you know, and so a lot of people have rejected him. He says, I want to tell you something. He's precious. And God didn't reject him. God chose him. And if we're smart, we're going to choose him because he is precious. He's that living stone there in verse 5. So you also as living stones are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. All right, number 2. So number 1, the answer to this, so we don't become vain, empty in our thinking. We need to learn of Jesus. Number 2, we need to be taught by Jesus. Notice that verse 21, Ephesians 4. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus. You know, and the point we're making earlier not just claiming facts about Jesus, but we need to learn him. Right? And again, learning facts, important. I'm not saying it's not. Right? We need to learn of the doctrine of Jesus. And the truth is, you know, that's the only way that we're going to learn Jesus. But if we stop at just the facts, we're missing the bigger picture. So we think for just a moment here, why is it that we should learn and be taught by Jesus? John chapter 8, 31 and 32. Jesus said, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make or set you free." Right, we know that passage well. And abide here, we're to abide in his teaching. We're to abide in the word of Jesus. We're to become his disciple, and a disciple of a teacher not only abided in their word, followed the word, learned the word, were taught by the word, but they also followed the teacher. Right? And if so, he's saying, you know, if you learn these things, you're willing to be taught, listen, you can become his disciples. You can know the truth. Truth will set you free. Not set free to do whatever you want, but set free from the bondage of sin and the consequences of that bondage. I want you to note here, finally, number three, kind of running out of time. We're going to pick up the pace and finish up here in just a moment. So number one, I need to learn Jesus, right? And learn of him also. But I need to be taught by Jesus. But number three here, I need to be dressed by Jesus. Now, this carries two parts, I believe. The first part, of course, like Galatians 3, 26, 28, when I obey the gospel there, it says, you know, to become a seed of Abraham, when you're baptized into Christ, you're clothed with Christ, you're dressed with Christ in baptism. Right? So there's that part when we obey the gospel, but then there's this daily dressing, if you will. Right now, I get that clean start, I get a start over, and so one of the things Paul's dealing with here is, I keep putting on the good stuff. And I keep working on getting rid of the bad stuff in my life. Right? Those destructive things my futile mind desires to do. And I'm putting on the good stuff, the new man, the new life. And so I need to be dressed by Jesus. So now we read what corrupts us as we put off those things. There in verse 22, he says, deceitful lusts. Right? And those are those stumbling blocks that we have, right? You got your stumbling blocks, I got mine. They're not always the same. You know what they look like in your life. I know what they look like in my life. Right? They look good, but you know, they look like something we need and want in our life, but when we get there and we're honest, it's not what they showed us they were. In the end, they're just really deceitful lusts. That's something you and I long for, but it's very destructive. And we need to put off some things and replace them. Look there at verse 24. "And that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness." Right? So the call here is to put on the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. Right? I need to learn Jesus. I need to be taught by Jesus. I need to be dressed by Jesus, right? And so this is a continuous effort in my life, right? It's not something that I do for a little bit and then go on cruise control. It didn't work that way, right? And you see here, what do I need to be dressed up with? Well, verses 23 and 24, a new mind. And once that mind is changed, and that's repentance, by the way, and then our behavior will change, verse 24, resulting in, as Paul writes, us being a new person or a new man. Now, doesn't that sound good? Right, don't you want to start over? Right. You finally see in our text here, we're reminded of our standard again. That's how this closes this section. In true righteousness, look at that last part of verse 24, in true righteousness and holiness. So how can I find out what is right? Well, I need to ask God. We need to be willing to learn Jesus, be taught by Jesus, be dressed by Jesus. Right? And so then I go to the standard, the holy revealed word, the Bible, you know, and I ask those questions. God, is this what I'm doing in my life right? Is it right in your eyes? Is it righteous? Is it holy? Real quick here, though, be reminded or be aware, real quick, Romans 10. You see, just because we claim that we want to be with God does not mean we're being honest with ourselves and therefore honest with God. Romans 10, notice what these people are doing in verse 2. Be reminded. It says, "For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God." Now stop for a moment. I believe these verses here talk about, for the main part, the religious attitude that we find in America today. We have so many people with such a zeal that want to talk about God. And sometimes we're tempted to mistake that as being right in the eyes of God, or being holy in the eyes of God. Like what we saw in Ephesians 4 and verse 24. Look at their zeal. They're so zealous. They say, "Hey, we're going to stand on the rooftop. I want to talk about God." So what's the problem? What's the issue? And here's where we can't fall for this. So yes, there's a zeal, but notice that last part in verse 2, but not according to knowledge. They haven't learned Jesus. They haven't been taught by Jesus. So they, verse 3, being ignorant, remember we've talked about ignorance and that slippery slope there in Ephesians 4, right? You can be ignorant about what is right. You can have a zeal for God and be ignorant about what's right. You ever met someone like that? Boy, they got a zeal for God, let me tell you. But they are ignorant about God. So you can be ignorant of God's righteousness, Paul writes, Romans 10, verse 3. And what do? It says they seek to establish their own righteousness, having not submitted to the righteousness of God. Let that never describe us. You know, so before I say, "Hey, I know I'm moral because I'm excited about God," I need to stop. I need to always stop and say, if I'm really excited about God, if I'm really zealous for God, then I'm going to ask God what is right. What is righteous? What is holiness? And it's never based upon my feelings. Let's end with this right here. Dr. Marshall Smith, a professor of business ethics, University of Central Florida, he came out with the results of a study the university did. It listed three things in order that determine people's ethical behavior in the workplace. Now, somewhat surprising, well, maybe not surprising if you think about it, but sad nonetheless, that the number one factor in determining what people will do ethically and morally in the workplace is their supervisor. Now, that's bad news and good news, right? So if you're here and you're a supervisor at work, a boss, an employer, you can have such great influence on those who work under you. The bad news is, that's the number one thing. If you got a supervisor that's immoral, and you know, number one thing's going to affect everyone under them. They're going to be morally and ethically willing to do bad things. But number two on the list is still not the individual. You can probably guess this. It was their peers, right? So it becomes, you know, what are my peers doing, right? So number one's the boss. If he's ethical or not ethical, peers, ethical, no, you know, you're going to do what your boss or your peers around you do. Then finally, number three, that person's own moral code affects what they do or don't do. And so I think it's obvious, you know, if it's not obvious, let's state the obvious. Do you realize that as faithful Christians, our moral conduct should always be based upon the fact that we know Christ, we've learned Christ, we allow him to continuously teach us, and we're allowing him to continuously dress us. That's the standard. So if my boss is immoral, that doesn't matter, right? I choose Christ. If my peers are immoral, it doesn't matter. I choose Christ. Or even if my own carnal, fleshly desires wants to do something that's wrong, I'm not going to do that because I choose Christ first. But our theme for the year, Walking Worthy, this study absolutely matters. We can't walk both roads. I know sometimes we try to, I want to walk the road that Sean wants to walk of the week. And boy, Sunday morning, it's easy to walk with the Lord. You can't do that. God has a standard, and I pray that we seek that standard, because if we don't, we're going to be very susceptible to this whole list that we see here. And it can and will happen to you if you're not careful. So this morning, I'd like us to think, as we're going to offer the Lord's invitation in a moment, who will be your standard of morality? And so as we extend the Lord's invitation, let's make sure that we respond with right reasoning, right? And I had a conversation with somebody earlier this morning, and we're talking about responding to the gospel. And here's the thing, here's how it works. When you're at that point and you're just about ready to respond, boy, Satan, it's like he grabs hold of your hand and says, no, don't go up there. Don't do it. You know how embarrassing that is if you go up there? Don't do it. People think less of you, right? You're admitting you have a sin problem. Don't do that. That's embarrassing, right? So he's going to try to intervene. Don't allow that to happen, right? And so your response needs to be based on what Christ offers you. You know, not on peer pressure, anybody around you, or even what your fleshly side would have you to do. So when we sing the song of invitation, if you're ready to obey the gospel, let's take care of that. It's mercy into Christ. Right? Yes, we got a potluck, but I guarantee we'll let that food get cold because we'd rather see you be immersed into Christ. Right? That food does not matter. Right? So if that applies to you, we'd love to help you with that. Or maybe you've went back into pollution. You've separated yourself from Christ. We can start all over. That's good news. You can come. We'd love to pray for you, pray with you, and get that reconciliation you need. So if you have any need whatsoever spiritually, let somebody know as we stand, as we sing.